Hi, folks. Jack Spirko here. Today you are listening to an episode of TSP Rewind. Commercial-free versions of past episodes. Podcast blasts from the past. I put these up when I can't do a show due to professional commitments or rare vacations. These podcasts will appear in standard iTunes, Stitcher, and other feeds, but will be titled TSP Rewind episodes and numbered accordingly. And today, folks, we're rewinding back to February 20th, 2019, about 1 year before the world was rocked by the COVIDs. And we're not talking about stuff like that today. We're continuing our series on permaculture this week while I'm down in Bastrop teaching that. And as I was thinking about the people that I wanted to bring into this three-part series, because the fourth one was just me yesterday, so who did I want to bring in? There's a lot of great names that could have been in this group, and they'll probably be in the next time I do something like this, you know, that I'll bring in. Nick Ferguson would be an exceptional one to do, or Paul Wheaton. But I wanted to bring some people maybe we haven't heard from in a while. And we do hear from Ben Falk occasionally on expert counsel. Like pretty much any question that comes in on permaculture that I think will fit him at all, I send to him because I don't get a ton for him. He's an amazing man. He's done amazing work. And when he approached me back in February of 2019, he wanted to come on and do a show about what he called Zone 4 Permaculture. And I was very interested in this. And this show talks about things like grafting certain things onto existing wild trees, like let's say certain apple species, crab apples, onto wild crab apples to feed deer and things like that. And this was an amazing, amazing episode. I was really pleased with the way it came out, and I wanted to include it today. What I want to say that since doing this episode, though, I've thought more and more about how this type of thinking, and not just the things he's talking about today. You take Nick Ferguson, for example, and all the work he's doing with fodder trees. What about a fodder tree system that's part of a zone 4, not for feeding livestock, but for feeding wildlife? Designed systemic browse for browsing ruminants like white-tailed deer. And I'm going to be actually including that in my presentation tomorrow down in Bastrop if you happen to catch it. And remember, if you can't come, you can tune in live online and see a lot of this stuff. Actually, it's not tomorrow, is it? Yeah, it's tomorrow. I'm sorry, I'm all off. It's actually Monday today when I'm recording this for the whole week. So yeah, it'll be tomorrow for you guys. You can tune into the Greater Reset online for free and see my presentation. And, you know, I do. I think we can begin to design Zone 4 systems, not just for ourselves, because Zone 4 is typically farm forestry, full-on farm forestry. We're designing a system that looks very much like a natural forest, but we're doing it to produce food, fibers, medicine, etc. for humans, and our Zone 5 is kind of untouched wilderness. The more I learn about what the Americas were like before European settlement, the more I'm beginning to believe that this type of thinking is probably the best thing we can do for a lot of areas that we also consider wilderness. That maybe even the entire Amazon rainforest, on some level, was designed by humans. I know that sounds crazy, but think about that as we go through this episode. This is going to be something we will dig deeper into in the future. I do believe it is one of the ways to address the issue that we discussed yesterday, the long, slow emergency of peak food, because there are no systems that truly can produce the abundance when properly managed, like true symbiotic natural systems. And Zone 4 permaculture is about as symbiotic and natural as it gets, with still being shaped somewhat by the hand of man. My last thing on that before I leave you with this old episode. We think that if it's touched by man, it's not a natural system. This is a denial of our innate nature as beings on this planet. We are as native to planet Earth as a deer or a jackrabbit or a microbe. We are part of this system. The thing that gives us the greatest adaptability and the greatest ability to influence things for the better is the same thing that gives us the greatest ability to influence things for the worse. It's not our hands or our feet. It's not the speed that we can run or the strength that we have. It's our brains. Our brains give us the ability to manipulate nature at an incredibly high level, more so than any other living thing on this planet, more so than any group of 10 living things on this planet. We can transform entire deserts into thriving ecosystems and entire thriving ecosystems into desolate desert. No other creature can do that because if they do, they immediately pay the consequence for it. Elephants can deforest an area and then they have to leave and it actually grows back because they have to. We have the ability to destroy and still take a yield. There's a word for that. Mining. If you're going to fight a thing, you have to fight it with the same technology, thinking, okay, but with like an anti-version thereof. So if thinking and developing unnatural systems is the problem, then thinking to develop natural systems just might be the solution. That's what Ben and I are about to talk about again. Originally, February 20th, 2019, Zone 4 Permaculture Design with Ben Falk. And remember, while these episodes are commercial free, you can always help support us simply by doing your online shopping starting at tspaz.com, where you get all my great recommendations. But no matter what you buy, you help us out. With that, I'm really excited to bring our special guest down. Of course, he is a member of the Expert Council. He is one of the better-known permaculturists in the world for good reason. He does specialize in northern climates because he lives in a little tundra of a state called New Hampshire, many of you have heard of, Free State Project. I'm sorry, why did I say he's in New Hampshire? He's in Vermont. It's like New Hampshire's cousin. anyway, he lives in the tundra of Vermont. I think he's USDA Zone 4. Too cold for me, but he does some really awesome stuff. I've been to his site. I've seen the amazing work that he's done. And when I was there, though, I really, because I was there for a PDC that I was a guest instructor at, I spent most of my time in what you would call his Zone 1, Zone 2 areas, and really didn't get out into his larger managed lands that we would call his Zone 4, Zone 5. And that's what we're going to talk about today. We're going to talk about helping wildlife get through those cold winters and how we can develop the truly regenerative systems, because nothing is more regenerative than the forest. And with that, hey, Ben, man, welcome to the Survival Podcast.
Hey, good to be here again, Jack.
I'm glad to have you on today. You're on the Expert Council, so the audience in general is pretty familiar with you, but we get new people every day, so... Could you kind of give us just a little bit of your background? Like, how did you end up living on this you know, beautiful permaculture place in Vermont? How'd you end up in permaculture? Like, take us back to, like, high school, and you're trying to figure out what to do with your life. How does that wonky path lead to where you are today?
Yeah, well, you know, trying to make it short because it's kind of a long path. But, I mean, I think it boils down to that I wanted to be outside a lot in a lot of ways. You know, like, I hated school. Hated just conformity and rules and just, you know, kind of a life that that I grew up with in, you know, public school, feeling like, look, this isn't how I want to live. Like, I don't know, you know, who decided this is, you know, these should be the goals. You know, you're supposed to go to an Ivy League school and then have some job in an office and work your way up management and, you know, make a lot of money. And that's how it should go. I always knew that was kind of what was being pushed on everyone, but it I was never sold on it. So it was always a bit of a struggle in school. Always found it really boring and just wanted to be outside. Fell in love with like rock climbing and backpacking and, you know, wilderness living pretty early on. And yeah, long story short, ended up going down that route a bunch. Oh, well, Red Walden, Henry David Thoreau, like in junior in high school, and was like, wow, this is the first example of like a way that I thought I would be good to live, you know, like, oh, this guy had to figure out he's like living in the woods. But, you know, of course, it's very like, you know, kind of edge type of person and, you know, wasn't what we were being pushed towards. So it was very like, how do I do that and still like have a life connected with the people around me and all this. So ended up going to do a wilderness kind of education approach, be a guide, and then found John Todd in ecological design in college, and then realized, okay, this is kind of a good way to like solve problems, but also work with your hands and work towards, you know, solutions that you see, you know, that you're compelled to work towards and, you know, be outside and kind of be your own boss and all that. And then from there found permaculture and, you know, all just made total sense to me. But yeah, it's been about 20 years of going down this rabbit hole of just living like a more self-made life, you know, more of like a homestead, land-based life, trying to solve problems, trying to hopefully do some good, but also live an enjoyable, you know, engaged life, which for me is like, you know, outside my hands on dirt and tools and, you know, in the mountains and in the rivers and all that. So, you know, kind of... That's the brief version of it anyway.
You know, very cool. not directly related to what we're talking about today, but certainly indirectly, one of the most important things that I heard you say there as you were trying to figure out your life was, how can I, versus wouldn't it be nice if? And I think there's a lot of permaculture mindset in that, even though that's pre-permaculture days for you. And I think that's a big mistake so many people make in their lives. Like, people always, like, when you tell somebody, like, I want to live like, you know, they talked about non-walled pond, well, that would be great if. And there's always an excuse as to why that can't be. But I think it's amazing what happens when we start to ask ourselves, how can I, rather than wouldn't it be nice if?
Right. Yeah, we're always kind of assuming we don't have power that we really do. And, yeah, kind of like folding, or you know, kind of like bending over to the larger power structures when we really could change our reality for the better for ourselves if we wanted, if we really thought we could, you know?
Absolutely. So I threw out a thing on Facebook, and we'll see what comes in from it with people having questions about the subject today. And it clued me into something. Sometimes I think I assume too much with what the audience knows because we've been talking about it for so long. So I mentioned that we would be talking about Zone 4 permaculture today, and some of the questions that started to roll in clearly indicated that they're like, well, but I'm in Zone 9, so we're talking about different zones there. We're talking about USDA climate zone. So before we dig into this topic, can you kind of tell people what you mean by – give us the – you know, the elevator explanation of permaculture zones again. We can't hear it too many times. And then what do you mean by Zone 4? Because when I look at the outline you have for today and our discussion pre the show, I'm kind of feeling almost like a Zone 4.5 thing going on. You know, it's kind of a hybrid between 5 and 4. So can you kind of make that clear?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, for just on the Zone 4 piece, you know, with permaculture being a design system that sees the landscape as a whole and really the world we interact with as a whole as a in terms of frequency of interaction, with zone zero, you could say, being the most frequent, could, depending on who you ask, zone zero is, let's say, our body, or some people would say it's our indoor environment, like our kitchen. Some people call zone zero our body, but that's up for debate. And zone five being wilderness, and then everything in between being like some gradation of how frequently you interact with it. Zone one being, let's say, the gardens right outside your house, between your house and your car for most people, because they're going to go to their car most days, or their chicken coop or whatever, and that's all zone one, where they can really maintain things very well, interact with on a daily basis. Zone two, less so. Maybe that's where you have like some of your berry bushes, maybe some animals, although like a chicken coop would be in zone one. And then out 3, 4, 5, 3 and 4 being more of like tree crop systems, or maybe some types of animal systems, and 4 being like a forestry type of system, you know, or part of the landscape where you maybe interact with it once a year. But you do still manage it to some extent. And zone 5 being like wilderness, quote unquote, for all the problems there are with that term, but an unmanaged landscape, you know, part of the landscape. So zone 4, permaculture being this kind of like area that we don't manage much, but we do have some leverage and we can make a difference there for the better, and can improve the landscape as a whole and our life as a result from some long, kind of long-term thinking management and light management.
Yeah, I mean, I've described it as designing your property so that you can live as a hunter-gatherer to a degree on your property.
Right. Like more, making a high, yeah.
You know, in the words of the late Toby Hemingway, thinking far more from a standpoint of a horticultural concept than an agricultural concept, with horticulture being the culture of plants and agriculture being the culture of fields. And kind of finding that balance. And see, what I like about when you started describing it, I was like, that sounds a lot like really zone five. Like, we can forage there and what have you, but it's really for the animals. But I've also been talking a lot lately about how we need to get off the binary thinking that not everything's on or off. Sometimes it's more like a dimmer switch. So as we move out in that zone four toward a zone five, you know, maybe our entire property doesn't even really have a zone five. Maybe we take some active approach, though it's a very hands-off approach, on all the property that we're blessed to have the ability to manage.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, absolutely. I mean, in some ways, the goal being the less, you know, the less we have to do, the better, right? You know, kind of the classic Fukuoka type of archetypal approach, right? Of like the more the system does for us, the better.
Absolutely.
Yeah, Zone 4 is where I think we really do have the classic opportunity to create this highly forageable landscape, like an intentionally forageable landscape, as you say, with the difference between agriculture and horticulture.
So one of the things that 4 does, and 5 as well, and actually everything if we do it right, but really 4 and 5, especially with larger animals, is it does provide habitat for animals other than our livestock. Let's say in your area, deer and black bear. My area, deer and the invasive boar, which they can invade all they want because they taste really good. And people think, okay, well, the wild animals just take care of themselves. But if we're actively managing our property, especially out in Zone 4, then we're going to put things in place that actually assist wildlife. Can you talk about why wildlife would need our assistance? I mean, they're wild animals.
Right, right. Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, there's a lot of pressures on wildlife that are relatively new, just like in a lot of parts of the country. For instance, you know, habitat reduction pressures, how human housing keeps growing. And so there's a lot less habitat in places. So they need our help from that perspective in a lot of places, just in that their habitat is being reduced. That's not true everywhere, but it is in many places. It's true in the fact that there's a lot less food available for them in some places than others, and some for reasons that most people would think, and some are more counterintuitive. In Vermont, for instance, there's a lot less field than there used to be, and a lot of wildlife really thrives at the edges of the field and forests. So one reason, for instance, that a lot of foresters I've talked to and kind of wildlife fish and game biologists talk about there being a lot less deer is because the farming has gone so downhill in Vermont over the last 100+ years that there's just a lot less of habitat for them in that way. Even though we don't think of that as a natural habitat, there used to be way, you know, it used to all be forest. Deer really thrive with some, you know, human management in that way, where they have a lot more food value in the landscape from things that humans used to do that we don't do anymore. So that's one example. And then, you know, things like losing the American chestnut, losing things like the passenger pigeon, you know, which there used to be billions of birds, and the interplay between passenger pigeon and many other species, which used to have an abundance, and the rest of the system that we no longer see happen anymore. So in some ways, you can think of this as just an ecosystem that's a lot less abundant than it used to be. So therefore, wildlife has less food options available, not just loss of habitat. For us, it's a lack of oaks is just a huge one. Like so much of the country has a lot of oaks, especially the eastern part of the country. But where we are, if we help oaks along, we have oaks. If we don't, you know, we're waiting for the oaks to spread themselves, which is only like 100 to 200, 300 yards, maybe a year of a dispersion due to blue jays and squirrels and chipmunks. So, you know, we can move acorns, you know, 20 or 100 miles in a year and start creating new waves of dispersion of a food that puts out way more fat and protein per area, per tree and per area than anything else that's growing here, because we don't really have any masting trees in this part of the world except beech, which is a pretty minimal yield, you know, because it's such a small nut. So that's like a huge leverage point. But everyone's going to have their own leverage point, you know, wherever they're located. We have a massive one in putting nut trees in. If you live where there's already a lot of nut trees, you have to find another yield or another leverage point. But for us, it's just like we have lifetimes of like putting nuts in this part of the world. You know, before we're done.
So here's like a completely reverse problem that's the same problem requiring assistance. So in a lot of the country, as the suburbs have spread and people have wanted to live more like they're in nature but not really in nature, they've done a pretty good job in a lot of these places of kind of building these suburbs less suburb-like, right? So that they have wood buffers between them and all. And this has created a massive amount of edge. And as you mentioned, white-tailed deer love that, so they move in. But now you have all this edge where they do really well in three quarters of the year, but in the winter, because there's no real wilderness, they don't have that support. So now you have an overpopulation relative to the total problem, and then without hunters, and a lot of these places, you know, they don't want the deer to eat their roses, but they also don't want the deer shot, then you don't have any kind of active population management. So you have a totally different, like, it's kind of amazing that we can create either a shortage or a surplus, and both of them, if they're not done right and managed right and aided, can be a problem.
Yeah, absolutely. And that winter food source is a huge hole too for us here, as it is for most parts of the country, you know, where we can try to have food, try to encourage food plots, tree crop food plots that bear a yield all through the whole winter. Not just tree crop. I mean, you can, you know, till and sow radish and turnip and all that. And we do that for the deer too. But we're particularly excited by like trees, any trees that hold fruit all year long.
Yeah.
All winter long.
For us, and I don't know how far north they do well, but, you know, down here and all the way up into like Pennsylvania, persimmon is just an incredibly important crop, because even though, you know, it'll be ready to pull off a tree, if you wanted to pull off a tree and eat it by early fall, a big native persimmon, those fruits will stay on that tree well into January, sometimes even February, and they slowly fall over time as the fruit bloats, and then it's incredibly high sugar carbohydrate yield. And I've seen a deer, like, eating persimmons under a tree. I wanted to shoot him, but he didn't come close enough. And he was eating persimmons. He ate every persimmon on the ground. He turned around and walked away. He made it about 30 yards from the tree, and a heavy wind came, and one persimmon fell off that tree. He heard it, and that deer spun around 180 degrees, trotted back over, ate the persimmon, and then left. and so it kind of tells you that there are these things that we could be doing. Like, that's an easy crop to propagate in a lot of the country, and people don't even think about it, you know? It's just something to make jam out of.
Yeah, I have friends who live in more persimmon country, and they always, you know, just laud that tree for its ability, especially to just hold on and just get better and better over time. It's holding on, you know, bledding, I guess, is the term for freezing and refreezing and just becoming more and more digestible, kind of pre-digested, although that doesn't sound very appetizing. It's really great with a fruit like that. And just, yeah, that being kind of a larder all winter for us, it's really apples. There's certain apples that can just hang on. We've tried persimmons. We planted a few hundred over the years, and I think we have a handful still alive, but they don't seem like they're really going to do it here.
Yeah, sometimes you can get survival, but not thriving, you know?
Right, yeah.
Let's talk about some of the wildlife in particular that we can help with land management. I think deer is a big one. Any others?
Turkey, bear, moose. I'd like to figure out more on the moose front, because they're doing really poorly here compared to bear and turkey, which are doing great, and deer not doing so well, but not as poorly as moose. I mean, anything, but, you know, from a permaculture lens, I think of it as like either the species that are really hurting the most, like insects, butterflies, you know, we're always leaving stands of milkweed and planting other stuff for the butterflies, but also more so, also food, you know, what is a wildlife crop for us too, that we can use to feed ourselves, so we don't have to get our food from somewhere else and damage or destroy some other part of the system to eat. So although it's nice from a let's just benefit wildlife as a whole perspective, like the grow pollinator garden for insects, I think there's a little bit of a bias in the permaculture end towards what can also help sustain us and help us meet our needs. So I think of like game, you know, any of the game species.
I mean, I didn't even take it down to things that you mentioned. Squirrels. Squirrels are an incredibly valuable component to the ecosystem, and when managed right, they almost, I am going to, you know, change what the game department say. The game department say they can't be over-harvest. They almost can't be over-harvest. We're talking about basically a animal that breeds very much like rats, but, you know, they only have usually two to three kits per litter, but they can have four or five a season. And it's a sustainable meat source. It really is. And like you mentioned, they also aid in the distribution because, you know, they bury a lot more nuts than they remember where they are. They really do. So, you know, that's another animal that, and I think what's interesting is like if you start, so you drill down and say, well, what does a squirrel need? Right? Like, okay, well, they need food. They need cover. They need places to breed. So if you designed that into a woodlot or a zone 4 system, how many other things is that going to, you know, end up supporting? Because if you can feed the squirrel, you can feed the deer. Now, the squirrel needs less, but they eat a lot of the same things. It break down to browse. Squirrels, I mean, a lot of people don't know, squirrels will feed a lot on you know, new buds and stuff like that when the mast is gone for the year, as they're waiting for that conversion over in the spring. So there's a lot of habitat similarities between the deer and the squirrel. That's why you usually have your deer hunting blown by some squirrel screaming at you from a tree across from your tree stand, because they live in the same place and they need the same stuff.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it was interesting too. With, I think probably one of the first things that only in retrospect I realized was teaching us that we could grow wildlife pretty quickly here, was the unintentional way that we grew squirrels and chipmunks by terracing and making stone walls throughout our slope, and then planting lots of, you know, food crops for people, especially things like black walnuts and hazelnuts, and just making all of this rodent habitat, which for us has actually been, you know, kind of a problem, because they eat a lot of the food we're growing for ourselves, vegetables and nuts especially. And but to see how quickly, you know, they responded from our changes to their habitat, which wasn't meant to grow, you know, more of their numbers, but did.
I don't know what to do about the chipmunks. I can give you a good squirrel stew recipe, but I think the chipmunk is down there at the you know, something else needs to be eating it. I don't think there's an ROI on processing a chipmunk.
Yeah, they're pretty small. And our squirrels are red squirrels, so they're
smaller.
Way smaller.
Well, they can live on pine cones, so they can do well where grays can't. Now, I think you've had problems with chipmunks specifically eating your shiitake mushrooms, right?
Mm-hmm. Shiitake, really, a lot of things in the last few. So we finally broke down after I've shot them and made like baited stumps with crushed nuts for years. And I'm just, you know, sick of taking the time, and B, just, you know, shooting rodents. But, and I would turn them to compost, turn them into soil, feed them back into the system. So we're essentially eating them, even if we're not directly.
Yeah.
They do help accelerate the compost. But we did finally break down and get a couple of outdoor cats, which, you know, but that's not too great of a solution, because we're not going to eat the cats, and that's not very much like a cyclical, you know, we're just trying to, what eats what is always the question, and we're not going to eat the cats. So,
no, but we did the same thing here, because, you know, we had 150 ducks at one point, and we started to have rodent problems with flat out rats, and a couple outdoor cats, rat problem is solved, cat's a buddy, he's not for eating, you know?
Right.
If you ever have surplus chipmunk, though, your dogs will eat them. Just, just so you know.
Yeah.
What areas do you think of are most suitable for? We were talking about growing wildlife.
Yeah. Well, I think it's not just a zone 4 thing, but for certain species, it is. As I said, you know, our zone 1 is really what grew the heck out of a whole bunch of rodents, unintentionally, but. You know, what we're doing on our larger site is planting out margins of a 15-acre field that have come up in some, when we stopped brush hogging, when we stopped having that area brush hogged, basically these margins have been brush hogged for 100 years by a local farmer before we owned the property. And we said, hey, you know, no need to keep knocking that down. It's all wet stuff that doesn't grow good hay, and that's why it was just being knocked back and not in hay production. So let's just see what's going to come up. You know, anything's going to be better than just keep knocking it back, probably. And at least we'll learn something from it. So starting in about year 3-4 of not cutting those areas, they're just started to come up into hundreds of apple trees, hawthorn, goldenrod, of course, which is kind of everywhere for us. And we realized that, you know, here's a whole orchard system that we don't have to plant, and it wants to come up of its own accord. It's going to be really adapted, vigorous rootstock, which it is, and actually wetland hardy, basically, because it's probably been trying to breed itself in these areas for a very long time, runners from older apples on the drier parts of the edges. And then we started grafting those apples with what I call turkey apples, are just these crabs that hang on, you know, all through the winter. And we had a question on the expert council about that in particular that I talked about. But that's one way, you know, all the Leopold called these areas, these kind of left out kind of in between areas on a farm, remises, R-E-M-I-S-E-S, SE, Farm Remises, and just really kind of wrote a lot about how you could just grow crops for wildlife, especially tree crops, in these areas. You could plant nut trees or fruit trees, or in this situation, I'm using an example, you could just top work trees, existing trees that are there to put on a more desirable, different type of yield. Like for us, a fruit that would stay on all winter, which is just such a key leverage point. And then we're also planting openings in the forest with oaks and walnuts and broadcasting those species really all around. There's wherever there's good openings for them, you know, kind of in the neighborhood, basically. But those are just some examples. I think other people in other contexts are going to come up with many different ones as well.
What are some of the, you know, we kind of started to go into that, but some of the other plants that might be more useful for doing this?
Well, I think, like, for us, as I mentioned, any nut is just going to provide a whole bunch of fat and protein that's not available in the landscape. And, like, our deer herd, I've been told, basically overwinters on apple drops and browse. And some years we have no apple drops. Mm. So another big key, you know, so there's just nothing. Like, this winter, there's some parts of the state that have some apples, but over large parts of the counties that I spend my time in, there's basically no apples. And so the deer are going to have, you know, luckily we're having a pretty mild winter all in all, but it's going to be a tough winter on the deer, and this is when they really get thinned out. So the other thing about these turkey apples, which again are just like a crab, ornamental-based crab apple, is not only that they hold through the whole winter, but that they bear as even more important than this, is that they bear every single year. They just always bear. And I know you had sent me an email about these and a good explanation for how they work. But that's just huge. I mean, reliability is massive, you know, in terms of a food source like that. So, yeah, apples, pears too, and any nut. But, you know, in other parts of the world, you just have to find what your limiting factors are. For us, it's totally winter food, which is true for a lot of places, and it's a lack of nuts. Because deer are overwintering on sugar, basically. So any fat and protein is going to be huge for them in the fall. Again, that's only a fall crop. They're not, you know, I don't know if a nut that holds on all winter, that would be pretty cool. But that's a storable calorie because, you know, if they gang up on walnuts or acorns in the fall, that could form a really good reserve layer, whereas not as much the case for a sugar, you know, a sugar source like an apple. But I think there's some pears that are going to probably prove to hold on pretty well as well. But I don't know of any that's as reliable as these like ornamental crabs, apples for us here.
Have you tried growing Antonovka at all?
Oh yeah, that's traditionally what I've planted.
Okay.
Is mostly been Antonovka rootstock. And then I've moved in the last like 5 years over to M111 for the wetter areas, which I should have been planting in the beginning on our wetter original site. But I didn't know that M111 is a more water adapted, wetland adapted rootstock because no one's ever told me that. But I'm pretty sure it's the case by looking at how they do in different places and then looking at the roots are totally different on M111 versus an Antonovka. The M111's roots look like a wetland plant, like a lily or something, mm-hmm. like super fibrous roots. And the Antonovka is like a taprooty.
Giant carrot. It looks like a giant carrot, yeah. So are you growing the Antonovka out or are you just grafting on an Antonovka rootstock?
Both.
Mm-hmm. I'm just wondering how the Antonovka is doing. That's a personal curiosity. I mean, I've got it growing everywhere here, but none of it's produced yet. It's pretty hot here. I don't know if it'll work, but...
Yeah, I mean, it's definitely a super cold-hardy rootstock.
But it's a pretty low-cost method of propagating apples. You can grow them from seed. You can buy rootstock and just let it grow. It's pretty awesome. I think somebody just wrote me wanting to grow some, and they didn't want to wait for seed, and I turned them on, I think, Raintree, and they bought rootstock for like $315 a piece. So
they
could, you know, plant 100 trees for $300, basically.
Yeah, you can get a lot of those Antonovka rootstocks, even some places for like a buck or two, you know, max a plant. A lot of times, when we planted our larger site, we planted almost 10,000 trees or so in a month and a half, and we knew we didn't have the time or the budget to buy pre-grafted stuff. So we're like, well, we're just going to plant this whole thing as a seedling system of hedgerows. and then we'll just top work it over time, and that's what we've been doing. And that's been a very viable approach, because then you have years, and you, the pressure's off, and you basically have the first 5 years easily to top work. And now some are getting a little tall. Like this last spring, we're like bending over some of the Antonovkas, which still hadn't gotten grafted and are like 10, 12 feet tall. And we're trying to add a tip to them. But generally, you know, we had at least 3 to 4 years, no problem of being able to reach everything easily.
Very cool. What are some other strategies you guys use to encourage and help wildlife?
Well, we're now growing wild rice, which has been another crop, which I think apparently people do so just for wildlife. Our you know, impetus wasn't per se for wildlife, because we just love the food source so much. It's such an ideal grain. You know, have this wild, truly wild grain. It's kind of like breaks
a lot of bounds. Are you doing that where you had been growing your, you know, your regular rice, your cultivated rice, or are you doing that out in these margins?
We're doing on the larger site, where there's just full on, like, there's about almost 3 acres of water, of open water.
Like marsh?
Well, they're ponds.
Okay.
And
okay.
One of them just is not, it's never been a great swimming pond, and it's nice and shallow throughout the whole thing.
Gotcha.
And it seems, we spread them everywhere, see where they like. And it seems like it's happiest between 2 and 4 feet of water. And it seems like about 90%+ of what we sowed 2 years ago came up. And then we just harvested a very little bit this year and mostly shattered it and tried to, you know, shake it back in to promote it growing again, reproduce it. And, you know, our goal is to have our own, you know, our own self sustaining grain yield from, let's say, half an acre of water. No, it's very extensive compared to the Japonica, Oryza Japonica, you know, which is an intensive rice. Totally different species, obviously, different genus, very different plant. But, you know, in the kind of system where we have like a lot of space and a lot of water, you know, the extensive system might be much more suitable than an intensive system.
That's very cool. I didn't know you were growing that. I mean, it makes me think I've seen – like, I think Michigan is one of the top producers of wild rice. These guys are just, like, rowing around in a canoe. They just take the heads over and smack them with an oar, and it just falls in the boat. And I'm like, you know, that's where you're onto something, because you're never going to harvest 100%. There's always going to be some to reseed. That's the exact place that thing wants to grow. It's probably been growing there since before humans walked on the shore of that body of water. And that's awesome. I didn't even know that anybody grew wild rice in Vermont.
Yeah, I think people are starting to. There's some hardcore ricers, you know, real rewilding, like forager types of folks who do go to Maine to actually harvest their year's worth of rice. And these people eat like a couple hundred pounds of rice or so in a year. You know, they really live. That's their grain source. And they go to Maine for it. But there are stands. I don't know how naturally occurring they are here and there in Vermont. I think the native Abenaki folks probably are the ones who would know the most about them. We've been trying to find out more about it, but they're very few, and there's certainly seemingly none in the hills. And we're trying to bring that sort those genetics to the hills. Cause I mean, what a sustaining like totem crop. That's kind of like where people, I think, have wild rice. That was like their coconut, you know, that was their like staff of life, for thousands of years, just such a sustainer.
You know, when people talk about stuff like that, I always wonder, like, is there something we don't even know? Like, that was like that for somebody, and it just got lost to time.
Oh, yeah.
You know, there's still stuff coming out of South America that, like, oh, we've used this forever. You didn't know about it? But I mean, like, right here, like, I'm sure there are things that, like, it just got bulldozed over, people missed it, nobody saw it. Like, one of the things I know of is out west, Manzanito, which is, like, these little apple things. That was an incredible food crop for the indigenous people, and like when Europeans settled it, they didn't even understand that was food. They just ignored it, and now it's pretty ornament wood inside people's fish tanks. Like, no one sees it as a food source at all anymore. So I wonder how many other things there are like that out there.
Yeah, there's so much rediscovery to do, and kind of resurrection and also development. Ideally, you know, like Jay Russell Smith popularly wrote about this, but other people have as well, of just breeding, you know, breeding new options for us too. That's kind of the lifelong, journey that some of us should try to take on.
So do you guys just grow stuff for wildlife, or do you grow things that are more for you guys as well in these zone four and a half type systems? You know, like, I know you do mushrooms for one example. Do you do that out in those systems, or?
Yeah. Well, originally for like 5 years or so, we grew shiitakes in kind of zone four, like up above the house in the woods. And that's just because that's where the maple logs were cut, were felled. And so hauling heavy stuff less distance was good. And then there was also water, some basic water source there. Not great, but I dug some holes and kind of had seasonal water there. And it was shady. So those are like good things to have in your laying yard. But really, over time, I realized we would just miss too many flushes, and the snail or slugs would get them. Rodents would get them. So I realized over time, look, if I really want shiitake, the shiitake needs to be in zone one, and it just haul the wood to zone one. It's a bit more work, but just if you're going to do it.
You get mushrooms.
If you want to get the mushrooms, it's a lot of work for nothing if you don't get the mushrooms. Even if you don't have to haul the wood very far, it's a waste of time. So, and you could have burned that nice sugar maple, sweet firewood, instead of rotting it intentionally. So I've now moved just trying to really grow, to just bringing the wood into zone one. And that's tricky because zone one isn't just necessarily a shady place. We want a lot of sun in zone one, and there's not a lot of good places for shiitake logs in my zone ones, but you know, there should be if you want to really get shiitake. So in some ways I've just grown less shiitake, not to focus on this crop too much, cause your question was about a lot of other things too, but basically I just try to walk around more and harvest, do more wild foraging for mushrooms. Cause we live in not an amazing place for wild mushrooms, but pretty darn good.
It's amazing compared to where I live.
Right, exactly.
It's pretty daggone solid.
It's good. Yeah. I don't know how much of it. I think it's really good, and I think some of it's due to me not being a great mushroom forager for sure. But I think sometimes the more moist coniferous woods seem to be even better, and especially where they have more oaks. Like, we don't have chicken of the woods, for instance, or hen of the woods. Well, we have some chicken. No hen, though, because there's so few oak. This chicken will happen on black cherry. But yeah, basically I'm saying, all right, I'm going to take all that time, I'm going to use it for wild foraging mushrooms instead, which I'd rather do anyway. It's just like walking around in the woods than drilling thousands of holes in logs. So mainly I've moved away from, you know, intentional shiitake production, but for the cornucopia of other mushrooms we have to harvest wild. But mainly, I mean, in zone four, those other species that we're talking about are mostly for wildlife, walnut, oak, chestnut, that we intend to hunt. I mean, I definitely intend to hunt some of those animals, turkey and deer. But there's definitely, I mean, definitely we would go and harvest those walnuts and acorns too for direct human use. But we'll probably have enough of those in zone two and three that we won't need to. It'll just be a question of, like, what are the best genetics and, you know, what do we feel like going to get? I mean, if we find, you know, we may have some walnuts that do really well that are in zone four that just seem like great nuts for us to harvest versus some in zone three. But, I mean, the fact is there's going to be more nuts than we can eat down the road in our systems. So, it's really for wildlife and the stuff that's in zone four for sure in our setting.
You know, one of the things I was thinking of when you were talking about this with turkeys, have you guys, especially like in your margins out on these types of systems, done anything with chufa?
No, I haven't. I've heard of chufa. I'm not familiar with it though at all.
It's pretty awesome. The only negative is when they do decide they want it, they kind of tear the ground up to get it. But that creates like turkey tilling, basically. So it's basically they call it earth almond. It's grown a lot in the Middle East. You can make a drink out of it. It's a lot like milk. It's considered a weed by a lot of people because it spreads by nodules, and it sets these little. They're about the size of like a like maybe three times the size of a shell pea.
Okay.
And turkeys love them. Pigs love them, too. You guys really don't have pigs, but turkeys love it. You know, like, if you wanted to, like, kind of clue your turkeys in, a lot of times they'll walk right past it, but if you pull a couple up so that they eat a couple and they figure out what it is, then they'll tear right into it and pull a bunch of it out. And so that might be something to look at, because I think that's hardy to, like, zone three.
Oh, interesting.
It's kind of like a pest grass, except it actually has nutritional value in the nut, you know, or the sedge or whatever you want to call it.
Sure. Interesting.
And it's cheap.
Well, that sounds really neat. One thing I guess I should mention from your last question that our wild rice is in zone four to some extent. It's kind of zone three, zone four, but it's definitely not zone one. So it's definitely a very not often interacted with extensive crop that is directly for us. I mean, that's our main intention. Although waterfowl food is good and I would hunt geese that's eating it, it's really for us, and that's a zone 3-4 crop for sure.
Very cool. Do you have any good books or video resources for people that want to learn more about this?
Yeah. Well, you know, a lot of this big picture kind of land management approach is very well covered in Tending the Wild, you know, M. Cat Anderson's famous book about Native American land management in what's now California. So that's a great overview, and it's a good way into kind of just a very, very clear window into how these resources and landscapes were managed for that part of the world. But then, you know, as I mentioned, Aldo Leopold, one of his lesser known works, he really talks a bit about farm remises. He doesn't get into tons of how to, but it's a good account of the concept at the very least. And he does have some how to. Then as far as other zone four permaculture resources, you know, I'm not really sure what's written as far as how to. There needs to be a good book on it. But I don't know of one that's specifically focused on that. You know, I know there's some guys out of Pennsylvania, Ben Weiss, I think, and Wilson Alvarez, who are pretty focused on Zone 4 permaculture as a whole, and they might be good to check out. Susquehanna Permaculture, you know, I know they've worked with this as a focus to some extent, but, you know, in some ways this really gets into the kind of the reverse wildcrafting, you know, foraging world, which is also very underrepresented as far as like the wildcrafters out there. You know, most people I think are trying to be good and sensitive, hopefully, to what they're harvesting, but they're not actually trying to, like, you know, inoculate the spaces with species and increasing the abundance of existing species of the plants and fungi that we're harvesting. But I think that's probably was done a lot of the time for thousands of years by, you know, First Peoples, for sure. I don't mean to say it's something new. You just don't really see a lot about it today, and certainly how to on it.
Sometimes I think we've gone too far knee-jerk in the opposite direction with that. Like, native peoples here in this landmass cultivated the wilderness, and they really didn't, like you said, I have a problem with that term, too. Because it creates this idea that somehow we are unnatural, and we live in our little houses in our little cities, and then wilderness is over there, and the only thing we can do by entering that is mess it up. And there's a lot of stuff that's been done to mess it up, but that doesn't mean that we're not supposed to be a natural piece of that system. So the thing is, we can think at a higher level than any other animal we know of anyway, so we can try to avoid stupid things like bringing kudzu to Atlanta, Georgia. But on the other hand, you often say native to when it comes to plants. So I hear about the scourge that is autumn olive, and I know that's a plant you and I both love. And the state of Texas, their official stance on the reason it's such a problem is that it so increases fertility that some of the plants that can only grow in really infertile areas stop growing in those areas because the areas become too fertile. Not that it doesn't spread everywhere and displace everything and eat your children. It takes infertile areas and makes them fertile. And I'm like, yeah,
And we want to be infertile, damn it, because that we've been infertile for so long, like maybe 100 or 200, 300 years.
Yeah, and that was the same places that they're crying about the fertility now. Those places were incredibly fertile before we screwed that up.
Sure, right, right.
And then you have a plant that wildlife can use. You have a plant that humans can use. And I've been amazed, like, what happens when that plant gets, like, run over by a bulldozer. So we had some road work done in West Virginia where there was a ton of wild autumn olive. And, you know, it's like you do what you can to not run stuff over, but there was a huge swath of it, and the bulldozer just smashed it.
Mm.
And that season, like, it just came back. It was bigger than it ever was. There were straight whips coming straight up, and they ended up covered in fruit.
Yeah.
And you could see which ones were the sweetest, because when the deer came, they would selectively eat the ones that tasted better first. And it was so it's like, oh, that was getting eaten. Let's go get some fruit off of that before it's gone, you know?
So much of the kind of reaction, the knee-jerk reaction against, you know, these quote-unquote invasive plants, it's so very aptly what you're saying. Like, we're literally, you know, we've abused the place to such an extent for long enough that we forget what the place, you know, was. And then we try to defend, you know, what the place it is now recently and think and create policies against anything that might change that. You know?
Well, the displacement thing is to me a weak argument because you mentioned chestnut. So in your part of the world, that was the big problem with the blight. Down in the southwest, southeastern United States, we had kind of the southern version of the chestnut, the chingapin.
Mm.
And it got its ass kicked just as bad. The same thing that killed the chestnuts killed the chingapins.
Mm.
And so they were like basically a smaller chestnut. In when I say smaller, I mean the nut was smaller. Mm-hmm. But the trees still are huge. And that all got wiped out too. So what came into that space? Like, you see what I'm saying? Like, there needs to be something there.
Mm-hmm.
If we want to put it back to like the way nature designed it, then we need something to be there. And if the original thing won't grow, then it's up to us to figure out what will without causing problems. Like, I see very few plants that are that really make my definition of invasive. Down here, privet is one that is definitely invasive. So privet, people put it all over these little box-looking hedges and their HOAs and stuff. But I can show you privet that's changed leaf form, and it's growing all over the area, and it specifically displaces a native plant, yaupon holly. So that is an invasive plant to me because it's displacing a native that was doing just fine before it got there, and it spreads on its own. English ivy, people say, is invasive, but it's almost like it's a vampire. Like, it can't go across an open field without being fried by the sun. So I can show you old neighborhoods here where the whole one side of the house is covered in English ivy, but I can't find English ivy causing a problem in the woods. And if it displaces anything, it displaces poison ivy. I'm kind of okay with that. I know I'm not supposed to be, but if you're going to displace anything, I'm kind of okay with poison ivy being displaced. So I think we have to look at the totality of what does this plant do? What does it actually displace? Does it displace anything? Is there a benefit? And I don't claim to be the guy that can make that decision. Like, I'm not a biologist that studied the wilderness for the last 30 years of my life, but I do think we do get overreactionary toward, you know, anything. And then, is it already there? Like, don't tell me not to plant autumn olive because it's invasive when the highway department went and planted this stuff up and down the highways for 25 years, and now it's everywhere that it could ever be, but I'm not supposed to have it on my property. To me, that also doesn't make any sense.
Right. Well, as you said, nature abhors a vacuum, and we ecosystems aren't static, and species are coming and going. And while it's a good goal to, you know, keep all the parts, you know, the intelligent tinkering starts with keeping all the parts, as Leopold says, and not throwing them out. Diversity is a good goal. We have lost. Certain things are just gone. They're out of the system. And, you know, now how do we work with those systems? We can't be constantly trying to maintain a static state that once was. That's, you know, A, we can't feed ourselves that way, and B, that's just not reality. So there is this kind of concept of, you know, working with novel ecosystems, and the fact that ecosystems are a constant, adaptive response to changing conditions, pollution, climate, disturbance and everything else. So, you know, the concept that there's, you know, kind of a natural composition is even very problematic ecologically, because what do we mean by that? Like, when? That's why I say native
when.
To when.
Oh,
when
I love that.
Is that natural? You well, know, it's not specific to a place. It's specific to a specific time in a place.
Absolutely. Like, there's a biome that ranges from parts of Texas all the way up into Montana called sagebrush steppe. And the junipers are, like, going crazy in that system because they screwed everything up. Well, they now call the juniper a invasive species in the sagebrush steppe, but it's a native species in the sagebrush. So nobody brought it there. It didn't invade. It filled that vacuum. And, like, when you have biologists calling a native plant invasive,
right.
Like, I think now we have really kind of lost focus on what's going on here. Getting rid of the juniper will not fix this problem. Putting something in there that grows with the juniper that used to keep it in balance, that's the issue. And, yeah, I don't want to beat too much up on this, but you know what I'm saying there. Like, that's,
yeah, well, it's
irrational.
Yeah, and it's an important conversation to have because it's so stagnant, you know, in the world around us. And I mean, even the term invasive is like, you start drilling down on it, like you're saying, it's really not, it's really a problematic term, and it's not really especially ecological. It just points to, like, usually a management problem or a lack of management. And if we were all, like, living in our landscapes, interacting with them in a very engaged and active way to get a yield, this whole concept of just, like, these invasive plants out of control would just change very, very quickly, because we would be actively managing them. It's not like these plants, you know, overnight you wake up one day in a system you're managing, you walk out and this plant's taken over everything. It's a process that's relatively slow, and it's happening in places that we don't usually manage very much, and usually is heavily disturbed, you know, abused and abandoned. So it's emerged, like, the whole nativist ideology is definitely only could have emerged in a context where people are engaged in their landscape with it more as a museum than, like, their food system. And it's interesting, if there's some articles out there floating around about how native peoples see this whole topic, and they kind of think it's, you know, as from what I've gleaned from some of this, they think it's kind of silly. They're looking at it like, look, these plants are playing a role. They're looking at it very ecologically, like, these plants are playing a role, and we kind of feel bad for these plants because you guys hate on them so hard, and they're just doing what they're doing to make a living as a result of what you have done to the system. You know, it's interesting. There's also the whole topic of ex situ conservation, which we just should mention here for people to look into, just the concept of that, since conditions are changing so much, that actually conserving certain species genetically means more often now than ever, or at least in a long time, that we have to promote species in places that they haven't lived before if we want them to survive.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And that's not just plants. That's animals, too. We have, you know, we have, like, game ranches here in Texas that are, and when people hear that, they think of, like, a canned hunt or something. We're talking, like, ranches that are, like, 25,000 acres, right? But they have animals on them that are highly endangered in their native habit, but we have an abundance of them here. Mm-hmm. And I'm not saying that's good or bad that we got to that point. But now that we are at that point, and that animal's living in that biome and doing well in that biome and surviving in that biome, and some of the countries that these animals are from today, let's just say their governments may not be really hip on worrying about this particular horned animal. You know, the fact that that animal is actually, like, its future is guaranteed in that place if we don't change it. Like, it's not going to go away. The fact that people will pay to go hunt it, you know, they're not going to kill them all because then they wouldn't have any more to do that with. You know, and so you could take that on again, like you said, the plants and things like that as well. Like, I'm a kind of off the permaculture thing. I'm kind of a fish nerd, and I do things with aquarium fish, and there's aquarium fish that don't even live where they originally came from anymore. They don't exist at all. They only exist in the aquarium trade. And, you know, I'm not for setting white cloud minnows loose in extreme in Texas or anything, but the fact that they are still around means that, let's say that the part of China where that fish is native to one day gets its shit together. The fact that there are thousands of aquarists that have stock of that fish give us the opportunity then to reintroduce that animal where it came from if the time ever arises. It's like a bank, I guess, like the seed bank in Norway or whatever, that type of thing.
Yeah, I mean, it's like the classic, like, you know, you keep tools around that you don't necessarily use every day, but you know you might need at some point. It's not a complete analogy, but there's a lot of truth in that comparison. You know, every species is an example of a fittingness to place, you know, of an evolution of some adaptation to circumstances, and those circumstances rise and fall. And, there's no need we want to preserve those adaptations, you know, not just throw them away, even when we know, you know, they may be thrown away in a particular place, because as you said, a lot of places are under incredible threat and they will, you know, they will go extinct in their native quote unquote range.
Well, and some of these places are so war torn right now. Like, I don't have time to worry about this minnow or this little deer or whatever it is. While my concern is, do I survive till tomorrow? And so, yeah, there's some validity there for sure. Moving on a little bit though, for people that want to do this stuff, where would you suggest people do things like get scion, plant material, seed, stuff like that for these uses?
Yeah, well, I mean, just back up for 1 second and say, sure. One of the things that people can do, just because I gave a pretty poor answer, I think, in terms of, you know, resources before, and because I do think there's not a lot of resources out there in terms of books, but I should, obviously, books are only one resource, but it's easy for our minds to just go there because other people can access the same books one has in one place in another place. But really, context-specific resources are the old-timers often in your place, and hunters, you know, talking to hunters, especially, and naturalists, other naturalists, not just, I think many good hunters, that's what they are, is good naturalists. But talking to those people in your, wherever you are, and saying, hey, you know, what animals are not doing well around here? And what do those animals eat? What do you see? You know, what do you see is really valuable for those animals? You can get great clues to your local area. That being said, finding, you know, the genetic resources to help them, the seed or scions, those can be in your local area. Often they already are, and you just have to find them and take, you know, cuttings. Like for us, we find the ornamental crabs that do the best in parking lots. Usually they are, because they're planted for ornamental uses, because they're always bearing heavy fruits and keeping them all winter. So they look, people think that looks cool. I guess it does, in parking areas and malls and all that, like plaza strips. And will, you know, always keep pruners in your car, riding shotgun or in your console. That's a first good principle, right? It's like, don't go anywhere without pruners. And you can get, you know, you can get those scions when you see an abundant tree that you want to reproduce the effects of on your land or somewhere else, take cuttings. So the landscape as a whole is a great resource. Ideally your local landscape, but if it's not there, you know, friends who can mail scion wood in the cool season, it's easy in a plastic bag to just ship some scion wood, you know, in a few days, it'll maintain its viability, in a Ziploc bag. The USDA germplasm lab, like, online, they will send you, well, it was shut down. I don't know if it's opened back up again from when the government got shut down recently, but they will mail scions for free to you, and they have all sorts of varieties. Many nurseries will send scions. Again, you want, you know, usually plants that hold fruit through your either dry or winter times that's one good approach anyway. Or have a yield that's not common there, like fat and protein for us. Yeah, I'd say those are pretty good resources. Your local landscape, nurseries, USDA. I don't know. Can you think of any others that I'm blanking on? I mean, friends and people that you find online.
Well, I'll tell you that one of the things that you can do, is check what your state nursery provides. And sometimes even there's like West Virginia. They reach a certain point during the year where they realize, okay, like, we're not going to sell everything we have. So they'll sell out of state once they come past a certain time of the year. Mm. And we got hybrid chestnuts, Chinese American crosses, for, I believe it was something stupid like 25 cents a tree by buying enough of them.
That's awesome. Yeah, that's great that that state nursery has hybrid chestnuts. Most don't. That's really cool.
It was like one of these things where like we were going to get like 2,000 of them, and by getting like 4,000 of them, the next 2,000 were almost free.
Yeah.
So totally. So that the state nurseries, I'm trying to think now. The name will come to me. Oh, is it Burnt? It's not Burnt Ridge. There's a nursery that I buy from all the time that they have some stupid cheap price on larger quantities. Like one of the things I would actually suggest you might want to take a look at is Hanson's Bush Cherry. That might be, and you can get those for, it's one of those things that your price point is like at 100 plants and it just goes dumb cheap.
Right.
So like, it's not Lawyers. Lawyers is one like that. It's this other one. And like I said, we'll hang up. It'll come to me. I'll put it in the show notes. That's a good place to look as well. And then I'm with you on the pruners, and I'm beyond pruners. I go somewhere, I'm looking for seed. I'm looking for something I can take a cutting of.
Mm-hmm.
Plain and simple, because if I get something that is adapted to my region, so if, when I go to the zoo, I'm looking at what they plant. I figure if they planted it, it's okay for me to plant it. You know, we have a wildlife preserve about a mile and a half from my place, and there is a huge mimosa tree, which is like a really good tree for bees. Mm-hmm. And it's like the only one I've seen anywhere around here. So I know the seed off of that tree. I need to be propagating that particular mimosa and getting some of that onto my property. So things like that. And then always, like if you find something that looks cool and you find seed off of it, I would suggest you find out what it is before you go propagating it. Like we found this really cool looking tree at that place. It was more like a shrub. It had these little, they looked like little, almost like little black chestnuts almost is what they looked like on it. And I was like, this is a cool-looking tree. I had seen it earlier when it was in flower. It was really beautiful. And it ended up being something called Mexican buckeye. And the seeds are sweet, so animals will eat them, but they're also toxic.
Hmm.
So you would not, you know, so make sure you, like, find out what it is and don't just assume things are what they are.
Sure.
Because I don't want, you know, something that's sweet and small enough for a duck to eat. And, you know, I could have 10 dead ducks back there in 5 minutes if I don't pay attention. And
right.
If you involve cattle in any of these systems, I know we're more of a zone three at that point. Don't ever underestimate the ability of a cow to kill itself. Like, just a side note, like a cow will figure out how to kill itself. Like, you've done everything you can, and the cow's like, I think I'm going to go over here and eat enough hedge apple to kill myself through impaction. So they will do it, right?
Oh, sheep will do it. Sheep will give them a good run for their money, potentially.
You pushed me away from sheep for the rest of my life. One day, and I was done. I had never seen anything like fly strike ever. That was
well. You're more in a goat climate, anyways. Right?
Yeah, we do. We have actually a sheep breed down here that avoids all the problems that you can get with fly strike. They're called Dorpers, and they're really a sheep, but it's almost like you took a big goat and crossed it with a sheep. They get big woolly fur, but then it falls off every year, so you don't have to shear them.
Sure.
And they will browse far more to the weedy side, like goats will. But they don't climb, you know, on top of your house, on top of your car, over a fence. Like, our saying down here is, if it won't hold water, it won't hold a goat. You know, it just, I don't like goats. I find the concept of having to deal with sheep displeasing. I just don't. The only thing I have for a goat is a 30-06. They're good. They taste good. Somebody else will take care of them. I love goat milk, but I don't want the management problem.
Sure. Yeah.
You kind of mentioned some people in Pennsylvania. Are there people out there that you think are good people to rely on to learn more about this stuff?
Yeah, well, I really think whatever your context is, it really wants to be so specific to your context and based on hopefully standing on legs that are old there of knowledge and experience. So I think your local neighbors who are naturalists and hunters are really going to be a good starting point to see, you know, to help you identify what are the holes in your ecosystem. You know, where are the limiting factors for animals thriving to help your local ecosystem? And again, not just the ecosystem itself, but you for a food source, in your specific place. And that being said, too, I mean, not to underestimate your own ability, your own experience with observation and just seeing, you know, what these holes are yourself, ideally, but tapping into that older experience. Beyond that, then maybe seek people who focus on this, you know, that might be permaculturists in your area. I really don't know of folks who have really made a focus on this beyond the folks I mentioned at Susquehanna Permaculture, just because I know they do a zone for permaculture focus. But that doesn't mean there's not other people out there. You know, there's Attending the Wild Facebook group that's kind of dedicated to this as a topic. I mean, any permaculture approach should take into account, but it's not a very active space, let's say, within the practice of permaculture. So it's not something like a lot of people don't also have the space maybe or time to focus on it. I mean, for us, it's evolved once our zone one systems and two systems are pretty set up and planted up densely and are kind of like, they're never done, but they're kind of like established and they're going. And we're now in much more like maintenance mode in year, you know, 5 to 10 to 15 on the different sites. So we start to look outward. Okay, how can we help these further out zones along?
Well, that makes sense, because I've been to your place. I've seen your yields, and you get to a point where, like, even if I made this better, what am I going to do with it now? Right? Like, you know, like I've seen you shake a plum tree and go, okay, well, he's good for plums for a while now. I mean,
The system allows you to start shifting your focus, you know, outward and even to offsite to assisting the ecosystems around you, then not just, you know, your quote unquote own systems. So I don't know. I know that's, you know, not a very satisfying answer, but I think that that's the reality of the situation, is really, you know, using your resources in people that may not be even calling any of this permaculture in your local area. You know.
Well, and your observation comment, I think, bears, like, what opportunity can you see that's easy? So, like, one of the things we did when we lived in Arkansas, we had a couple neighbors that they didn't care if we walked up their road, went on their property, whatever. That was just all woods, basically. And as long as you were known, you were fine to be there. And so this road that went up the backside of the mountain on the ridge behind us was covered in blackberries in the early summer. And we noticed that, like, all of the blackberries that were growing just off the road, where there were deep ruts in the road that would fill up with water and act like a swale, were much bigger and heavier blackberries. So we took a shovel and we cut little ruts, not in the road, but in the ground just in front of the blackberry hedges, so they would fill up with water. And then by the next season, those blackberries were doing way better than they were before. So that we didn't even have to plant anything. We didn't prune anything. We didn't graft anything. All we did was create a little bit of deposition trap for water.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you got to think about doing, like, when you do something else happens, right? But that was a pretty low risk, hey, let's see if this works type of thing. And it gave a much better yield. So that's, and there's no way you're going to pick every blackberry. Game and what's not is going to get some of it. Squirrels love them. So there's a lot of stuff that you can do there. I would like, before I let you go, to throw a little bit of the stuff off of Facebook at you real quick. And you can do the Reader's Digest if you want to on some of this. But one guy asked about, like, kind of set it and forget it crops that we can use. And you talked about some of those. But he mentioned Jerusalem artichokes. Would you consider that a zone 4 crop at all?
Yeah, that's a great thing to bring up. Jerusalem artichoke is a great example of, like, this permanent producing potato, basically. You know, it's a starch crop. It's kind of like a grain type of replacement. It's a permanently producing year after year calorie, you know, carbohydrate crop that basically, you know, you set in disturbed ground and let it get going with a minimal of care in the first year. Like, you can till a strip. We'll, like, till whole strips in different areas that are in between that we're not going to crop. And then we'll stuff in pieces of Jerusalem artichoke from, like, the year or two old or older strips that we keep doing new strips every year and propagating from the year before or 5 year before strips with pieces of root. And you plug those in as root pieces and you have a place that's permanently producing calories, and pollinator habitat and all sorts of other wildlife yields for, you know, darn near forever until they're shaded out by tree succession. And that's a great example of something that's, like, very easy to establish in zone 4. I like to joke, you know, a .22 rifle and Jerusalem artichokes is like your kind of background, like best survival strategy.
Now, you're not wrong. No, you dead on.
Yeah, I mean, if you have Jerusalem artichokes, some wild greens, which are everywhere, and, you know, like a meat source, you know, you're gonna get by. I mean, they're just a really true kind of back of the cellar survival strategy. I'll be honest, I don't eat tons of them. I mean, they call them for artichokes for a reason. They are that high in the, I guess it's the inulin content. The sugar is, you know, a little hard to break down or a lot hard to break down for some people, but you can definitely slow cook them. You can lacto ferment them like a sauerkraut, which tends to help sometimes a lot. And we love pureed soup. Like if you do a slow cook a soup and then puree, that seems to be definitely way better. As far as digestibility, they're great for diabetics because I guess the sugar being different, they're a lot less likely to spike the blood sugar on diabetic folks. Great, definitely a great option is a plant like Jerusalem artichoke or an analogous plant to wherever you live.
Sure, anything that would do
for
that.
For sure.
Yeah, I found that the best artichoke therapy is to eat small amounts of them. If you eat a little bit, you know, so you make dinner, you cut one up, you fry it like potatoes, and everybody eats a little bit, and you don't have a noisy night. If you make a plate full, and then you said it works for some and not others. I found lacto-fermented, I can eat as many of them as I want, and it doesn't do anything.
Actually, you know, pickles, too. My wife made pickled them, and it's awesome.
Really?
Yeah, I think they were lacto-fermented to some extent, but they were more so just in a pickled situation, like in the fridge for months on end, and really, really, I mean, that was kind of my favorite way to eat them besides the pureed soup. They were like really, really tasty.
Awesome, man. I grow them in containers, big containers, because they when they send a runner up against the wall of the container, they set all their nodules right there, so you just reach down and pull them out, and you can leave them in over winter. Mm-hmm. So you harvest them because our winters aren't bad. So like I'm not out there with a hammer trying to get in there. So I can just go out and take like two out and just harvest all winter, and then they just start growing back.
Yeah,
and it's awesome. Yeah. So here I got a complex one, but I think this is actually a really interesting one, and it's right in line with what we're talking about today. Drew from Facebook, I'm on 21 acres. No, that's the wrong one. I'm sorry. Sorry, Drew. Matthew, I have a 100 plus year. 3-acre grove, but it's made up almost entirely of silver maple. It's in a decline phase currently. Any tips on how to transition it to a long-term healthy zone 4? Looking to be able to encourage wildlife and have some more wild edibles. Currently, I have ramps, wild raspberries, wild strawberry, and elderberries growing that came up on their own, and especially want to replace the aging silver maple overgrowth. Any thoughts on that? If you want climate, real quick, you have climate too. North Central Iowa, 30 inches of rain. Mostly flat, USDA zone 4-5. Sounds familiar, except you're not flat.
Yeah, that's cool. I didn't know there was any really zone 4 in Iowa. That's cool. I looked on your Facebook to see this so I can see the question.
Yeah, he says surrounded by corn and soybean. So there you go. There's the Iowa part.
Right. It is actually Iowa. I think that was one of the places my mind went right off was if you can kind of accelerate the succession here and find like the worst of the silver maple zone, like where it's furthest along in senescence, and actually, you know, drop some and get some sun in for the next phase. That would be one way to potentially look at it. I don't want you to jump to that because without knowing the system very well, I can't say for sure, but that would be a good thing to consider as you are, you probably do want it. You do kind of have to get some sun in there to transition it to certain systems, although there is some shade, heavy shade worthy stuff you could grow, but just the list is a lot shorter of what's possible there. I mean, a lot of it depends on your goals too. I don't really see any goals written down. Like if it's like I want to get as much medicine out of this as possible, or as much calorie crops out of it as possible, or I want to be as much value for my grazing herd as possible. Those are all obviously very different treatments to apply. So goals are, you know, without goals, you can't really say. But
yeah, are we looking to do this like a Mark Shepherd style where animals graze in alleys, or are we looking this to be woods when you're done? Like that's
yeah,
that
I mean,
matters.
I'm, I'm assuming it's the goals are human food, but that may not be the case. And also, yeah. Then how close is this? Is this going to be zone one, or is it always going to be? Is it going to be zone four? Is this far from your house? Is it?
Well, he does say he wants it to be a healthy zone four system, and he is concerned about making it good for wildlife. So we do know that.
Yeah. Okay, there are those goals. That's true. Yeah, I mean, increasing diversity, and again, looking at what is limited in your area. So if you're in, trees are really valuable, more valuable in that part of the world than they are here, all things being equal, because you're in Iowa, and as you say, you're surrounded by corn and soy. So, yeah, I mean, I probably would look to what would be the next tree system. So looking to it for it to go back into trees, given that there's probably, there's such few acreage, a percentage of acreage and tree cover in that part of the world. And those are like island refuges for wildlife there, where they can get away from the big fields. So probably dropping some trees, as they allude to, so you can plant others. Because if you plant in the understory, they'll limp along. But then when the big silver maples fall down, 100-year-old silver maples could be 120 feet tall and like fall over in all directions. They get really like multi-stemmed off, and they can take out your next, tree crops you're trying to promote.
Sure.
So sometimes the first, tool to use to promote the next forest is a chainsaw, even though that sounds obviously like the opposite direction. So that's probably, strongly got to consider that. And then planting what is most limited in that area probably is going to be pretty heavy on nuts, just for the food value alone for wildlife. But it could be some fruits that hold through the winter too. Those would be kind of on the top of my list. The same kind of general tree categories that we focus on here, I think is safe to say there. But I wouldn't limit it to that. I would really try to get to know the area, and they probably already do, like what's really limited there.
Yeah, I'm hesitant to say too much without really knowing what we're dealing with. I mean, one of the things that always makes me feel better about cutting trees down is if I put water in. So if there's some small pond sites that can go in there with the creation of some glades, and when I'm done, now I have an opening, I can grow on the edges and the margins these new trees, and I've got water, now things are really starting to feel a lot better about taking down these older trees.
Yeah.
I was in Iowa a couple of years ago, not really a long overwintering tree, but the one tree that I saw that was productive, that there were a lot of growing native, were native mulberry. So that would be something, you could look toward. That's not a real high value long-term tree, but that's like in consort with nuts, you get something faster,
Good to have in the mix for sure. It sounds like a riparian floodplain forest to me from everything they're saying.
Yeah.
I don't know if pawpaws would take it in that climate, but looking across the board, I know there's a Caria species. I'm not familiar with it because I don't live with it, but I know there's a hickory that does really well in floodplains, I think. Looking at that plant in particular, what's going to really thrive in that type of system there? It sounds like a clay plain forest in some way.
Yeah, buy some chestnuts from Mark Shepherd. They're kind of been, moved toward that direction. So
yeah, although the chestnuts really like gravelly, sandy, they may not like this loamy clay. It's like clay, but maybe our chestnuts have been very finicky and like only our sandiest spots.
Really?
But yeah, and I've heard that they really like almost like gravelly soils, which I don't have, but it makes sense to me seeing them grow.
Given the grape culture in a lot of their they're native, because we're growing basically Chinese, which I think are closer to European chestnuts than they are to the original American. So, if you look at where chestnuts grow in Italy and France and all, they grow a lot like where the Gamay grapes and all grow, and they grow in really, really gravelly places. So, I never really thought of that, but that makes sense.
Yeah, quite droughty.
I think that'll wrap up Facebook. A lot of stuff that was because I didn't explain myself and people were talking about USDA
I see their ones.
Jake wants to know what the highest value and lowest effort producing edible from zone four is. I'd say deer. I don't think he means it that way, but that's bang, okay, I got 90 pounds of meat.
yeah and the J choke goes in with that question too a bit.
Yeah. He only asked one. We gotta give him credit.
Right.
I gotta give Jake a shout out, man. At the last workshop he was at, he was fantastic. He was a pleasure to have around. We had the rule, but we didn't need it. You know, it was great. Anyway, man, tell people how they can learn more about you, and if anything you got coming up that maybe people could come out and learn from you or anything like that.
Sure. Yeah. Well, Whole Systems Design. You know, keep up on the website. My Facebook page is pretty active. I haven't been on the Instagram page in a while, taking a little break from that. But yeah, go to our website, wholesystemsdesign.com. We have our permaculture course yearly coming up. We have our apprenticeship in the spring, 2 weeks this year. That's mostly full, but there's some spots left, maybe one. And we're doing a bunch of cool courses. They're all on the website. We're doing some natural movement courses at our new site, where we'll focus on a bit of this as well. One of the days will be focused on, you know, zone 4 permaculture, you know, rewilding the landscape as a whole around you. So, yeah.
Let me throw in a plug for your book, man. We were talking about zone 4 today, and your book really tends to focus more on the 1, 2, 3 zones, because that's what you were developing when you wrote it.
Yeah.
And it is kind of angled toward the northern climates because that's where you live. But I think it's a fantastic book. It's one of the most practical permaculture books from this is what I did, this is how it worked, this is what did work, this is what did work, where people actually want to do something rather than think about maybe doing something someday. So I really recommend your book. And as far as your courses, I it's worth the fee to take one of Ben's courses just to walk his property. It is a fantastically amazing property, and it is. I've been to a lot of sites, Ben, and I haven't been to yours for years. I need to figure out a way to get back up there to see it again because I know it's changed. But I've been to a lot of sites. You have something really unique in what you've done on your property, man. It's pretty spectacular.
Oh, thanks, man. Well, it was great to have you up here. We'll have to make it happen again. Come the high summer, you know, when it's nice and hot out and.
When I'll be shivering in my tent at 64 degrees.
Yeah, you'll be soaking wet cold in your tent.
At 64, I'll be cold. Anyway, man, thanks for being with us today, Ben. I appreciate you. Have a great day. And, you know, thank you also for serving on the Expert Council. But anytime you have a subject you want to talk about, get with us. We'll get you on the air.
Sounds good. Thanks a lot, Jack. We'll talk to you later.
Great stuff as always from Ben. I really enjoyed that discussion. I mean, I sit here on my little 3-acre piece, and I feel pretty blessed to have that. But as I was saying when we were talking, I would love to have, you know, even 20 acres. And those of you that are looking at larger properties, and you find a property and it's mostly wooded, and you're thinking, I want to do all this stuff that Jack talks about and swales and stuff, don't let it put you off. I really mean it. I think if I had, you know, 10 acres and up, I don't care if it's 1,000 acres, I would probably manage 1 to 3 kind of as open space management. You know, maybe you go into those woods and maybe you find an opportune spot and you put some dams and ponds and stuff in those woods, but most of it I would leave as managed woodlands. I think that is kind of the best of all things, and the abundance that you get in a system like that, and it is infinitely, infinitely sustainable. Like, we talk sometimes about the difference between sustainable and regenerative, and sustainable basically means barely surviving in some people's minds. And I think it depends. I think, you know, we're back to that thing, like, it's not, the binary thinking is what got us into problems in the first place. You know, regenerative is a sustainable thing. That's the way I look at this. So instead of thinking as an on-off switch, so if you start turning a dimmer switch up and the light comes on, and let's say that becomes sustainable, that means that we can keep doing things this way for a very long time, but if anything goes wrong, the dimmer switch turns down, it stops. Well, then how far up can you turn that dimmer switch? That's what I think of when I think of sustainable. And let's turn that dimmer switch up as far as we can till we have a bright light. And that's what I think managed forestry really is. It is infinitely sustainable, i.e. regenerative.